welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. This is John Baker on a great day here in Atlanta. It seems like every week I say that again. The weather has just been unbelievable. One of these days we'll get in here and I'll say, welcome to Biz Rocket Radio. It is horribly nasty outside, rainy, sleety, and snowy. But then again, it'll still be a great day. So I want to welcome in our guests. We've got three ladies in today that are going to be talking to us about serving on boards, and we're going to talk a little bit about serving on nonprofit boards and then also serving on for-profit boards and some of the differences between the two and why you'd want to serve on each one of them. But first, I want to just get a chance to introduce everybody and get a little background on you guys, so we'll kind of walk through that real quick. Our first guest is Janet Lathrop, and Janet is with A Path to Better Performance. So welcome in.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit of your background and kind of how you got to where you are now.
Okay. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and grew up in healthcare, worked in the Children's Hospital Emergency Department, moved here to Atlanta to help sort of merge Scottish Rite and Eggleston together into the Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. And then for the last 15 years, worked at the National Commission on Certification of Physician Assistants, which is the organization that is the de facto licensing organization for PAs. And then earlier this year, left with a partner to open up Path to Better Performance, which is a consultant organization that sort of focuses on helping organizations improve performance through operational efficiencies and developing their people.
So, and I understand you're also getting your PhD?
Yes. And in the evenings, I'm in a PhD program. I'm in the dissertation phase for a PhD in business with a focus on organizational development. Therefore, my topic is the motivational factors of nonprofit volunteer board members.
And so you're going to be a doctor.
I'm going to be a doctor.
Is that exciting?
Yes, it's very exciting. Yeah. I tell my family I just can't wait to be called Dr. Lathrop.
Right?
Seven years.
Are you going to make everybody call you doctor?
Oh, of course.
Because you have to,
I have to. Yeah. I earned it.
You have earned it. My sister got her doctorates in psychology, psychology, and I can't bring myself to call her doctor. Dr. Baker, will you please come to the board? So tell us a little bit more about your business. What do you guys do with your business?
Well, it's fairly new. We are just starting out. We opened up in July, and we're sort of targeting our sweet spot would be small to mid-sized nonprofits, 501c6s, mm-hmm. Healthcare, startup organizations. Healthcare is our background. But really looking to help look at an organization's processes, evaluate them, and help them to put efficiencies in place to help them save money and help the bottom line, which is a big deal now for nonprofit all organizations, but especially in healthcare mm-hmm. and in the nonprofit world.
Yeah, for sure. So you are very active with Children's and mm-hmm. Eggleston and mm-hmm. that whole nine yards. We are there all the time with our four kids, two of which have cystic fibrosis. So we're literally there all the time.
Yeah, Scottish Rite.
Yeah, it's Scottish Rite. Mm-hmm. And actually now at Emory, they've got some stuff going on there and also mm-hmm. in Augusta as well. So thank you for all your work you've done there.
You're welcome. Yeah.
So if anybody wanted to reach out to you kind of after the show, mm-hmm. do you have any contact information that would be good for them to reach out to you?
Yep, we have an email address if anyone's interested in more information. Our website is www.bpconsulting.com, and there's a link for info at BP Consulting.
One last question on the business. Is there a certain process that you go through to help people kind of get that down?
That's a great question. And yes, there is. There's what we do, something called an organizational profile. It's initial assessment of the organization, the processes. And our focus is, or our foundation is, we base it on the Baldrige criteria, which are seven criteria for performance excellence. And it's sort of a nice foundation and something the organization understands going in, that this is sort of how we're going to approach it. It's broken down by strategic planning and in different sections or seven different criteria. When we were at our last job, my business partner and I, we won the Georgia Oglethorpe Award, which is the state version of the Baldrige. So we sort of believe in that, and we've seen it work. So that's how we base our foundation of the assessment.
where it all starts from.
Yep.
Well, good. Well, welcome in.
Thank you.
We'll get back to you just in a second.
Okay.
Our next guest is Diane Basco, and Diane is an account executive with AttachMate. Welcome in.
Thank you, John.
Good and I got your last name. I nailed it.
You did it right.
Yes.
Yay.
Basco. It's Basco. So, Diane, maybe a little background on you and kind of how you got to where you are.
Sure. Like Janet, from New York. Transplanted about 34 years ago to the Atlanta area, and kind of an unusual start to my career. I was a flight attendant for 13 years, and people always, when they look at my resume, say, how did you get from there to where you're at? And, you know, frankly, I think that being a person that's driven around service, and if you're going to be a flight attendant, you have to have a passion for that. It really has played well in the roles I've played, mostly in sales, high-tech type sales companies. I've been with a software company and I've been with a hardware company, Cisco Systems. You may have heard, small company.
Small little tiny company, gobbling the world.
That's right. And, you know, I'm at the phase in my career where I had a great run and I'm at the twilight, sort of stepping off, slowing down.
Right.
And I'm with AttachMate, which is a great software company headquartered out of Seattle. Most people haven't heard of them. It's not too small, $1.2 billion in sales. And just a good culture, and slower pace than what I was used to at Cisco. So, and I happen to own a small business as well, which came to be about 10 years ago. I own a small private school, which is another unusual. People always say, how do you own a school? I didn't think you could do that, but absolutely do. And
Montessori, right?
It's a Montessori school in Cumming, Georgia, Ivy League Montessori. And you know, that came to be, I was at probably the height of my career when I was at Cisco, and I was approached. It was, I didn't start the school. It was established 11 years prior, and the owner said, I know this is crazy, but would you and your husband like to own the school? Well, for me, I was already starting to think, what would I do life after Cisco? So I thought this would be something to give back. And I had a passion about it because my twin girls happened to be enrolled in the school, and I knew what Montessori can do in terms of education for children, and we are sorely in need in reform. And so that was my key motivation. And it's truly been a give back because I haven't taken a dime. You won't make any money owning a private school, but
labor of love,
it's a labor of love for sure. Yeah.
How did you make the decision to go there? I mean, that seems like a pretty big step from you're kind of trying to wind down some other things, and all of a sudden you take on this brand new big kind of monster that you've never even dealt with before.
Well, I think part of it, because I was at Cisco, financially we had the wherewithal to take that on. So we were able to back the buy of the school, the purchase. And because I had a staff that was in place that are completely competent and to this day run the day-to-day. I don't run the day-to-day. But I had a vision for what I wanted to take the school. And so when I first acquired it, it was just really a preschool up through the kindergarten year. I've since done two rounds of funding and expanded the school all the way through the elementary program. So a lower elementary and then an upper elementary. And, you know, that's where it stopped. When my girls graduated out of the upper elementary, the parents looked at me and said, well, are you going to do the middle school next? And, you know, my husband and I looked at each other and said, no. No, we knew that we wanted to step away at some point. And, you know, it's a big commitment to get behind that. So
that was the transition. So now you're kind of
I still work. Yeah. I still work. You have to work. You have to have an income. Yeah. And so AttachMate is where I'm at, and I keep it going. And it's just been so rewarding to go over. I should say that it adjoins my personal property, so it's really easy for me to walk over and during the school day and see these kids go into the classroom. It's just amazing.
The school adjoins your property.
Yes,
wow.
It is.
That's very convenient.
Yeah, very convenient.
And literally in your backyard.
My front yard in this case.
Front yard.
It adjoins the road, yeah.
Well, perfect. That sounds like a neat little setup you got going on. Tell us a little bit about AttachMate and what do you guys do over there?
So company's been around 32 years privately held, which is largely why most people don't know about us.
Sure.
And they got their start in creating software that allowed PCs to talk to mainframes. Think about IBM mainframes. Years ago, nobody had a PC on their desk. They had a dumb terminal, and that was the only way you could communicate. So the business got started with software that emulated or mimicked a dumb terminal and allows PCs to connect. Well, that business grew and expanded to many, many different types of host platforms. Through acquisitions, we branched into security and into cloud computing. So we made a large acquisition last year of Novell and SUSE Linux, so the operating system. So we're really poised to provide enterprise-type solutions that are pretty much mission critical, that are running most large enterprise. So the Fortune, or actually I should say the Global 1000, probably 90% of them use our products.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Well, good stuff. Well, welcome in.
Thank you very much.
And now we'll get back to the general conversation here in a second. Our next guest is Marva Baylor, and Marva is with IBM. So she's actually, you know, who you used to work with,
I guess. That's right.
Yeah. Or maybe still do. So welcome in, Marva.
Thank you.
Maybe a little bit of background on you, kind of where you came from and how you got to where you are.
So I have had a long journey in sales, and I'm from the Maryland, D.C. area, and I've run multiple companies in the federal space. And I had the opportunity to get acquired by IBM, actually right before Christmas in 2006. And as you know, IBM's been making several acquisitions. They made over, we're expected to do about $20 billion in acquisitions by 2015. So it's really interesting because we're moving into a culture of people that have been there for, I mean, I think Diane actually worked at IBM one time in a career, and especially in the Atlanta area, you'll find there's always someone that either worked there or their parents worked there or their grandparents worked there.
Right.
So I'm moving into a organization where you're coming in, and most people's average tenure is about 20, 25 years, and some people even 35 years.
Yeah.
So I've really enjoyed the Atlanta area, doing a lot of mentoring and business networking. I'm very involved with a lot of boards here, as well as networking groups and technology leadership groups.
And how has your experience been when you transitioned? Because we talk a lot, executives and business owners are always kind of involved in transitions, whether it's from one job to the next or from a takeover or a buyout. How was your experience when the transition occurred with you and with IBM?
So people always ask me that, and one thing people always ask is, oh, wow, IBM's so big, they must have a lot of processes. The one thing that really struck me was really the diversity. So it was not just diversity of race or gender, but diversity of age. So, you know, I'm from a sales background and very similar to Diane's, and we typically would have I call it the fraternity sales force. So everyone's about the same age, went to the same school, likes the same football team or whatever.
Right. Go Terps, right?
Redskins, actually.
Oh, there you go. Come on, RG3, come on.
I'm a Terp, but, you know, SEC rules, and I love Georgia, by the way.
All right, well, yeah.
And I got a son who wants to go to Georgia and a daughter that wants to go to Georgia Tech, so we'll be a house divided. But we are Redskins fans. And
nice.
We're working on being Falcons fans because they're doing a nice job as well.
You got to support the home team.
Yes. But that's really been the biggest change, has been the diversity.
So all of you guys are involved in some sort of nonprofit or for-profit boards. And maybe you guys could talk a little bit about how you got involved in the organization that you champion and what really motivated you to do that. And I'll just kind of leave that as an open question.
Well, I guess I'll go first.
Okay.
So for me, the linkage to sitting on a for-profit board, and I sit on the as an advisory board member to Alliance National Bank, which is a community bank up in Cumming, Georgia. That linkage is directly related to the ownership of my school. So they happen to hold the loan to my small business.
Right.
And I've gotten, you know, over the years, as you could imagine, a lot of times small banks morph from one bank to the next, and a lot of times the folks that start these banks stay in place. So I've known the principals at this bank for probably, a decade, as long as I've owned the school. And so they've come to know me as a business owner in the community, and they know my background. And so they approached me as they moved into the Forsyth County area, they got their startup in Dalton, Georgia, which is the carpet manufacturer capital of the world. And as you can imagine, they've been hit really hard with the economic downturn. So that bank struggled in that community, so they had to branch into a new community. So Forsyth County was selected, but they didn't have the ties into the community, so they set up an advisory board with business leaders and owners within that community to help them assimilate into the community, and you know, that's how that happened for me. And I'm fairly new, about 6 months mm-hmm. into it.
And just a couple more questions on that I'm curious about. On the for-profit side, mm-hmm. now I know that, Janet, you're on the nonprofit for the most part, and Diane...
Marva's
on the nonprofit also. Okay, so only for-profit. Yeah. You're the only capitalist in the room.
That's right.
All right. So, Diane, when you're looking on the for-profit side of things, what do you see as the primary, maybe three or four things that those boards are really looking to accomplish from their group?
Well, let me first qualify again. I'm an advisory board member. So today, you know, oftentimes when we say board, you think of a governing board, which is your traditional fiduciary responsibility, governing legal responsibility. I do not sit on that board.
Okay.
So the advisory board is kind of a new trend. I don't have to be held to those kinds of rigors.
Yep.
And so it's free-flowing ideas. It is, there's definitely a value, and I think we'll touch on that, and why do I do this? Because it's completely voluntary. There's no money involved.
Yep.
But it's a win-win for both sides. So that's, you know, qualifying that.
What kind of things have you benefited from? Obviously, they're benefiting from your knowledge and your connections and all that stuff. How have you benefited?
Well, you know, so when you first get asked, you know, honestly, the feeling you get, you're flattered, right?
Yeah.
You know, you've been asked, would you consider?
Yeah.
And so you get past that, and you have to recognize this is all about your time, too. Can you commit? And it's not, it's quarterly, you know, quarterly events. They've done a really great job in setting up guest speakers that have either a direct or an indirect value to the members that sit on the advisory board, and we come from all walks of life. So, you know, I've got doctors and dentists and land developers and, you know, as colleagues on the board. And I've personally been very interested in the topics that, you know, they brought to the table. And it makes you feel like, what can I give back to this bank? I mean, yes, they know me. When I go for another round of funding, I feel more comfortable that they're likely to say yes. So there's definitely, that's the direct benefit for me, mm-hmm. but there's been that indirect by the guest speakers they've had and lined up for us at these meetings.
Perfect. What about you guys? Marva, Janet?
I have kind of an interesting story. So, as I mentioned, I was acquired by IBM and I work for a startup, and I was traveling a lot, and I was trying to discern if I wanted to stay at IBM or not, because I did, you know, I have a choice. We all have choices. So I was at the Crown Room and I was reading the Delta magazine. It was called Pink. She doesn't make it anymore. It's now an online magazine. So give a little shout out for Pink Magazine. And there was a woman on the cover, and she had her arms outstretched, and it said Woman of the Year. And I read the article, and it was about a woman named Ann Kramer. And it turns out she works for IBM. And I reached out to her, and I got a meeting in 2 days, which I was pretty impressed, since she's a pretty well-known woman here in town in Atlanta, but also nationally. And I got a meeting with her, and she said, oh, dear. She always says, dear. Oh, dear Marva, please stay. We need more energetic people like you. And what attracted me to Anne was, it was talking about her board service. And she's on Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. She's on Rosalind Carter's board, Atlanta Women Foundation. And it's just literally numerous, hundreds of boards in her career she's been on. And I'm in my 40s, and like the rest of us, we're in our 40s and 50s, and a lot of us say, well, I want to be on a board when I retire. But that's not when you should be on a board. You should be on a board now, at the height of your career, when you have ideas and a company and a network behind you that you can actually give back. And we also all have passionate causes that we are interested in, just like you have cystic fibrosis. And you can give money, and you can do a walkathon, and you can give time. But if you could really make a difference in that organization with your time and talents now, this is the time to do it. So that's how I was introduced to the concept that, yes, you can be on a board. And by the way, you don't have to be a C-level executive at IBM, that there's opportunities for people that are in management and not C-level executives. So she encouraged me to be open to that. And then that's how I then got introduced to being on the TechBridge board.
And tell us where that passion came from choosing what board you wanted to be on, or was it more of a, here's a spot that's available and go talk to them?
Well, she actually, IBM's a very well-known company here in Atlanta, and we actually do have a list of boards that they are looking for people. But the way I actually got on TechBridge board was kind of different. I actually went to the ball. We have a large ball every year. All the CIOs in town go, and we really rally around the cause. And our board member from IBM had to step down because he had a new job. And I was networking with everybody and really just getting involved with it. And he said, hey, you know, Marva, and this was the first time I met this gentleman, by the way, I think you would be perfect for this board. So I actually interviewed on the spot at the bar.
That's the best way to interview.
With the COO and the CEO. And then I had a formal interview with their legal department and their board chairman. And then I was asked to be on the board.
Perfect. Perfect. And you've been doing that how long now?
I've been doing it for 3 years now.
Oh, okay.
And we've been successful in the digital ball every single year. I have a co-chair. His name's Clint Bailey from Hunter Technologies. It's awesome. And we have a huge group of volunteers and a great staff. So it's been a great experience.
Has it been primarily fundraising? Is the main focus on that board, or is it operations as well?
No, it's it's so many things. It's fundraising. We also had to determine what the products and services are that TechBridge was going to sell. TechBridge is a nonprofit for other nonprofits. So they provide technology services such as donor management systems, setting up when they get a bunch of PCs donated to maybe do an educational training room.
Oh, okay.
So to try to figure out what are the products and services that they can replicate and sell and monetize to help the nonprofits be able to do their missions more effectively so they don't have to be, you know, messing around with their IT and telecom needs.
Great idea. Great idea. Yeah, certainly. On the CF side of things, which I've been a board member of for quite some time, that's always the issue. You get all these people running around. No one can talk to anyone unless they have some technology. They don't have the money to buy it, you know. So that's cool.
Yeah, we also help with grants, with them getting grants. Mm-hmm. So that's been very rewarding as well. So we help in a lot of ways.
Your sales experience helps with the grant piece, eh?
It does help. And it's interesting because people on the board I think there's only two of us that have sales backgrounds. Most people are CEOs or operational backgrounds, and we have a lot of financial experts and lawyers, mm-hmm. but we don't really have a lot of salespeople.
Yeah. Well, good on you.
Thank you.
Janet, how about you? What's your experience?
So my perspective and experience is a little bit different than the ladies. I come from the side of managing the board of directors, the nonprofit volunteer board of directors. And unlike Marva's experience in C3s, where there's a lot of development and grants and heavily relied upon money from the community, the C6 and the NCCPA, where I manage that board, isn't like that. There is no development. In fact, as a C6, they can't get money like that. So our organization was a service organization. Mission was still to the public, sort of assured the public that these physician assistants had the skills and knowledge necessary to practice medicine. Mm-hmm. But the 23 board member group that I managed were nationally represented physicians and lawyers and community members. And so their job was less about sales and fundraising and more about running the organization, which as a CEO is a challenge in many, many good ways. But they're very involved in the strategic direction, unlike sort of the for-profit side where there's a big focus on the bottom line. In the nonprofit 501c6 space, there's more of a focus on the mission.
Mm-hmm. And so you had the opportunity to manage a group of physicians and people in that role. Have you already gotten your angel's wings, or are those just coming later? From managing,
I was born with them.
I was going to say that's a challenging deal. What's been the biggest challenge for you in trying to do that? That's not easy.
I would say it's in leading them in the strategic direction that's right for the organization, at least from my perspective and my team's perspective. Many of the individuals on the board are members of the profession we're governing. So as you can imagine, sometimes it's hard to sit on a board and be the judge and jury of your peers. And for instance, we would set, the cut score of where you would, the amount of questions you needed to get right to pass the exam and get certified and thereby work. There's a lot of pressure externally to them for people to pass. It doesn't, we're like the long arm of the law. So it's a challenge for board members to keep the right perspective and keep the focus on the mission versus the popular choice for the profession.
What would you say are some of the, involved in that whole process, what would you say some of the top issues that you had to deal with that were very challenging for you and challenging for the board?
Probably one of the biggest challenge I faced was having a new boss every year, because essentially as CEO, I have 23 bosses as 23 board members, but then there's always a chairman of the board or a facilitator. And really, it's just a facilitator role, but what would happen is the individual would come on and, of course, want to do a fabulous job and want to help run the organization. And that's something I welcomed, but the difference was if their perspective or their agenda, if you will, was different than the will of the full board, it was always a challenge managing that CEO-chairman of the board relationship.
Right.
And it changed just as I got to know someone, it changed. Yep. It's like every year I had a new boss.
Yep. What have you gotten out of it in the experience? How long have you been doing it? How long have you been involved?
I was there 15 years.
Wow. So, and are you still involved with it, doing it now? Not so much.
Okay. No. Now what I do in my role at Path to Better Performance is help other organizations, nonprofits, help their board understand their role and help their CEOs build that foundation of trust.
And really, you've kind of combined the business experiences that you've had and then these not-for-profit board experiences, and you're kind of building that into a business.
That's right. And doing my dissertation on trying to discover, as we are this morning, the motivational factors, because we're at a time now where, especially in the nonprofit space, when people really are volunteering their time for different motivational rewards, it's difficult for them to get the time away from work and the discretionary funds to do it, and what we as nonprofit leaders of CEO organizations need to know in order to attract and retain the people on our boards.
So I'm going to get to motivation in a second. What do you think the biggest thing that you took out of that experience was? Clearly, you kind of have a business around that, but what else?
I would say the value and the need for the foundation of trust to exist between the board and the staff leader, the CEO, because everything else, that sort of dictates everything. If there's a foundation of trust and your board trusts that you're transparent and knowledgeable and forthcoming, everything else is easy. Anytime that trust is shaken, which probably happens quite a bit, I was fortunate to have a fabulous board that was very trusting. But you hear a lot of stories where when the individuals on the board are questioning the abilities and or the actions of the CEO, it creates an environment where you can't move forward and you can't grow and you can't even sustain yourself as an organization.
Yep.
That's a really good point. I'm learning more about board governance because there's a skill to it, and a lot of times the board members don't really understand that there's rules and regulations and the behind the scenes. They just want to jump right in and give their great ideas. I was just made aware, I hope I'm going to have the opportunity to do it next year, but the Georgia Terry School of Business actually has a board governance class. It's actually just happened.
Director's College last week.
Which is awesome. So that's a great resource that we have here in Atlanta. And then the Atlanta Women's Foundation has a similar type of class, but it's more for nonprofit boards. And I think, if you are going to be very serious, if it's something you want to do, I think it is important for board members to make a commitment sometime in their career to get that education.
Good stuff. How do you know, and kind of as a general question, how do you know when you're ready? Or do you really know when you're ready to serve on either, and I'm going to make this a two-part question, and then I'm going to have a follow-up kind of around motivation, but how do you know when you're ready, and then how do you choose between doing something with a for-profit, and that's right for you, versus a not-for-profit, and you feel like that's right for you? Mm. Come on, three ladies. I know you guys are going to jump in and take this question.
Well, the for-profit is typically, you know, for people that they're trying to attract to their board to grow the revenue or the network. And the C-level executives that, you know, I'm friends with, that is actually part of their career, that they do have to focus on different boards of adjacent industries. And there also is, again, governance and specifics around that. A lot of times people will get asked to be on a board because of the partnership or of a mentoring relationship. That seems to be very popular. I understand, like, our past CEO, the boards that he was on, a lot of that was driven via his mentorship. So I think that's a different stage in your career. And then there's also the startup community, which is very big here in Atlanta. And people are going to, again, select specific people on their boards because they have financial contacts, legal contacts that can generate revenue and focus for their business.
You know, I'd say a lot depends on where you're at in your career and in your personal life. So how much time do you have? So if I look back at when I was in the peak of my career at Cisco, running a very large organization for them, tons of responsibility, lots and lots of stress, owned the school, that would not have been the right time. I would not have a moment to spare to volunteer. But because I've stepped back, the timing is right. As I said before, there is a direct relationship of a personal benefit for me in participating. And so I think in terms of for-profit, if you are still growing your career path, that can be a very good avenue for you to take the next leap by putting that on as a credential that you've served. So I think there's different motivations, different points in your career or your life.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I don't really have anything to add other than, for me personally, having never been on a board, as I'm now growing my new business, I'm finding it very beneficial. And when you do the cost-benefit analysis, and some very smart person named Marva said to me yesterday, you really need to consider getting on a board now. And so for me, it's sort of the timing as well.
And would that be into a professional side of the board or on the...
To be as a board member.
A board member on the professional side, not nonprofit.
Right.
For profit.
Right.
Okay. So let's talk about which board you choose and kind of how you determine which one is going to be best for you. How important is it that it's in line with a passion of yours? I mean, that organization or that cause, is that something that's critical or not really?
I think you need to have a passion for what you're doing. You also need to be careful that, you know, you're not doing something for, you know, for, I guess, selfish reasons. You need to be doing it because you know you're going to be able to help. You obviously don't want to be on a board, I would say probably the reverse, that goes against your personal values. That probably might not be somewhere that you would want to spend your time. I actually got interviewed recently for a blog for IBM called Citizen IBM, and I wrote a white paper on the ROI of giving. And there really is an ROI. And I think the best way to think about it with work-life balance, there is no I'm doing this now and do I have the time. It all needs to blend. And you need to figure out how to make it blend with your family, your work, your career, and your friends. And if you start thinking of it that way, it's not going to be as a big task, like, oh, I'll have to give up X to be able to commit to this. So I think if you look at it as an integral part of your life and your personality, it's going to come natural to you.
I would just add to that, having led boards, that there are people who decide to come on boards to change things. And that is very frustrating to the other board members and to the leadership, because you have a plan, you have a strategic plan, you have a well-thought-out operational plan, you've got buy-in, and you get an individual that comes on the board with the sole purpose of trying to change your strategic direction. Very disruptive for the organization. And back to some of the challenges as a leader, it's keeping that culture of trust and, you know, having individuals understand the culture of the organization when they come on the board and not be disruptive.
Well, now, how do you distinguish, though, when an organization needs that disruption and needs that change? I mean, isn't it fair to say that sometimes people have become complacent on a board and they have a strategic plan, they're driving in a direction, but frankly, they're driving the wrong way? How do you balance those two things?
It's a great question, and it is a delicate balance. I mean, they don't really mean the same thing to me. As long as you have your fresh perspective and you're constantly revisiting your strategic plan, that shouldn't be a problem. This is an individual that I'm thinking of that would likely come on the board knowing that, but believe that it's the wrong decision, even though it's been well thought out by the board, and then want to change it. So, I mean, and you don't know what you're getting. You don't know in the beginning, and then they're ingrained in your culture. They're part of the board. It's very difficult to remove a board member. You have bylaw constraints around removal and such. And so it's just, you know, I guess it's educating them on here's what we've done. Here's what we spent 6 years developing. Here's our strategic plan and our operational plan. Here's our goals and our outcomes. You know, and make sure that those board members buy into them in the beginning and can support them.
And Diane, I guess my, John, I'm sort of unique in that I didn't make that decision for for-profit or non-profit. They approached me. So they called me and said, we would like to invite you to be a participant in our advisory board, and would I be interested? And they took my resume and they looked it over. And like I said, they knew me for about a decade. And so they asked me to sit on their board. So it wasn't something I was in the works of preparing to do. But now that I've had the opportunity to do it, and I can see in the future when I do retire, whatever the next phase of my career is, because I don't know that you ever really retire, at least not in my mind, but I can see myself now going and proactively looking and seeking nonprofit participation in the future. I still have two 16-year-olds at home that I gotta stay on top of.
Yeah, in a big way.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
When you started getting involved in that whole process, obviously there must have been some intrepidation going into it, not really knowing what to expect.
You know, because I knew it wasn't a governing board, I wasn't signing up from a legal perspective. I wasn't really taking a lot of risk. It was advisory. And so, really, there's really just everything to gain.
Yeah.
And it's been a great experience.
When did you find that the needle went in the direction of, hey, this is kind of cool. I can get behind this thing versus, yeah, these are a bunch of jerks and I don't really want to hang out with them.
I think in the very first quarterly meeting, when I met my colleagues, the other advisory members on the board, and I got to interact with other unique business owners in the community, I had no network capability to reach out to these people prior, and it was very fascinating to me to have those links established through the board. So it was definitely positive. I've not seen any downside to my participation.
Now, we've seen a trend actually in advisory boards. I think you'll see nonprofits will have them. You'll see personal executives will have them. I know at IBM we have them for our different brands of software. One example is we have a nuclear regulatory advisory board, and we get our customers together all around the world that have to do with nuclear regulatory. You'll see that. And what it happens is, you know, you've heard of focus groups or the executive customers. You're getting the input from basically your clients, but then you're also creating this network. And now it could potentially be a global network. And it's not just a network of the individuals. It's also their network of their affiliation and association, which sort of ties into Janet's, where why the doctors care, because now they're getting to meet other doctors or other PAs or other people in their profession. So this whole advisory board, it really does help with that network. And it's sort of the next level of education. So, you know, we talked about doctorates and master's degrees, but what happens after that? And a lot of times people get those degrees very early in their career. Yeah. So what happens when you're 50 and 60? How are you going to keep learning and get that network? So advisory boards is an excellent way to do that.
Have you guys found that from your board experience or nonprofit experience that you have gained some of that education? And how? If so.
Yeah, I'll take that. It's an interesting thing because I was thinking through what are the motivators, and knowledge and just your expansion of knowledge is one of the motivators, because, I mean, for Marv and I in sales, we deal with customers in all types of markets and verticals. And the more conversant you can become in their line of business, the more effective you are, the better value you bring to the table for them. And so small banking, community banking. I don't know anything about community banking, but I'm learning a lot about community banking. And that will translate in my ability to serve my large customers that happen to be in retail banking. So mm-hmm. I am learning about the inner workings of retail banking.
Janet, how about you? Have you found anything that many years in doing this, from an educational perspective, it forced you to kind of continue that passion?
Well, it's forced me to have a great appreciation, and I think I did before, but even more so in the value of building relationships and maintaining relationships and transparency, really, as the leader, to be as forthcoming and transparent as you can to the board, because at the end of the day, they're in it with you. They're the team. They have, as Diane mentioned, fiduciary responsibilities. To build that foundation of trust that I've talked about, that I believe is at the heart of it. And oftentimes, especially in different professions, for instance, my board was mainly clinicians. Luckily, they were advanced and usually were deans or, you know, had business degrees, but many times they don't have a background in finance and they don't understand their responsibilities. So you have varying people with varying degrees of understanding. And sort of for me to understand that you don't come into a room, you don't hire people that have the skills to do this job. These are volunteers that may or may not have some or all of the skills that are required to lead and have that burden of responsibility, the fiduciary responsibility and the Sarbanes-Oxley and all those things that they need to be aware of as board members.
Anything to add, Marv?
One thing that I learned was really meeting with, again, diversity. So the board that I'm on has people from my competitors, and we actually ended up becoming really good friends. So like Microsoft and SAP, and turns out we thought we were competitors and we're really not. And then the customers that we have, we actually are dealing with the CEOs of the company. And it's very interesting when they all get in a room together, because they're used to having big staffs behind them to execute. Right. And so when they come up with the ideas, I'm sure this is one of Janet's things, they come up with the ideas and then they think they can just walk away, but it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
You have to come up with the idea and execute the idea.
It, yeah.
So I'd say that those have been the two learnings that I came away with.
And that's a great segue to the next question that I had, which is, when being involved in these types of boards, what do you see as characteristics that make that board productive? Because there are boards that are just, you know, you meet once a quarter, you meet two times a year, and it's in the meeting you get all these great ideas, and you get all this excitement going around, and then you come to the next meeting, and it's like, did anything get accomplished? How do you get, if you're our listeners that are involved in boards now or looking at becoming involved in boards, what are some of the common characteristics that you guys feel make a board effective?
Well, I'll start with that and say that I think it relies heavily on your staff leadership, whether it's keeping the board informed, giving them the right materials in between meetings, developing an agenda book that is for the meeting that is gives the scan of the environment but doesn't lead the board, and the board itself comes to the consensus of the decisions to be made. And so I guess from my experience, and I believe I had a pretty happy board for all those years, it's communicating and letting them know, providing status of the goals and the outcomes and where we are, tying them to the financial sort of metrics. They like to see this goal or this outcome, we spent X amount of money and we got this much, you know, ROI off of it, and sort of just the knowing what they're interested in understanding and what they need to understand and providing that information to them.
So it sounds like you are an excellent facilitator, Janet. And one thing that I've noticed is when the CEO is very clear of what things they need help and need input on, it makes it a lot easier, because otherwise everyone is literally second-guessing every decision and trying to give you all their advice, and you don't need advice for 10 of the 18 things you have.
Exactly right. It's a balance of knowing, you know, sort of knowing when we can take the ball as staff and when we need the board strategic guidance in the areas we don't understand.
Great. Janet, question for you on the research that you've been doing for your dissertation.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about what you found in that research that maybe you didn't know before, just from experiencing the board.
Well,
the way you did.
Truthfully, there's been nothing thus far that has surprised me. Even to the degree of just some stats, like for instance, gender. You see more women on nonprofit boards, and yeah. We were talking earlier amongst ourselves about why. We have varying opinions and ideas on maybe why, but on the average for the nonprofit board, half of them are women. On the for-profit boards, 80% are men, so only 20% are women, which didn't surprise me. The average age is also older. 50% of nonprofit board members are 50 and above. And 37% are 38 and above. So almost the entire board is 38 years old or later in the nonprofit.
And why do you think that? Why do you think, because you said you had some discussions on why women are on more nonprofits and not men. Do women just care more than men?
Of course, yes.
Me?
Women care more. They're better at multitasking. They give back. Actually,
TechBridge is more men. We actually were striving to have more diversity on our board. But we're a technology-oriented focus, so maybe that's.
I think that's the key, yeah. There's not enough women in technology fields. I mean, we're definitely the minority, Marva.
And it's not really so much fundraising. As it is, there's some fundraising, but there's a lot of other aspects to it.
Oh, yeah, we're the IT department and telecom department and applications department for 60-plus nonprofits here in the Atlanta area. Yeah. So, absolutely.
So, what is it about nonprofits that puts the above 40, 80% of the people are involved in it are above 40?
I would actually venture to say, though I haven't looked at the research, that it's probably the same age also on the for-profits. And I think it's back to what we were saying earlier, which is where you're at in your career. Mm. You know, you're fresh out and you're in your early 30s. It's probably not on your mind to go join a board, nor I would imagine maybe the company would be less inclined to sponsor you at that point in time. And boards want some experience. Yeah. Granted, we don't need C-levels, but we do need individuals with some experience because that's what you need them around the table, especially as these advisory boards grow more and more. In fact, I'm just putting together an advisory board for my little consultant company. So,
And we have one for ours. Yeah. Well, I have an advisory council for our business as well, and it's great. Mm-hmm. It really is. So you get great feedback. You get great information. So from a benefit side from the business, it's fantastic to have people to volunteer their time. And I think it's interesting for executives and business owners that are listening to attract, retain, and provide a benefit for those people that are there is so critical. Mm-hmm. Or else they just fall off, and it ends up becoming, kind of a failed process. And that's why your input on that is more valuable, Diane, than knowing what you did and what you like about it, and the speaker, and getting some benefits from that. But the networking seems to be kind of a big piece.
Exactly. I mean, for me, owning a small private school, if you think about it, these other business owners, let's say a dentist who sits on the board with me, he has lots and lots of patients. You know, he has an opportunity to interact and say, I know about Ivy League Montessori School. I mean, so the linkages are there. We're not advertising to each other.
Right.
But as we establish those relationships, they're more likely to, in conversation, in their own business practice, to recommend. Just like I would be more apt to go to that dentist that I establish a relationship with.
Right. Really, I mean, networking is great wherever you do it,
right? That's
right. Whether it's Kettering Networking Group or something like this. Mm-hmm. Any closing thoughts? Any closing thoughts that you guys want to leave? I call them pearls of wisdom, but we'll call them closing thoughts today for our listeners.
Well, this week is Make a Difference Week and Make a Difference Day, which is on Saturday. And I would encourage all of the listeners out there to make a difference and to not wait. We cannot wait. You can't wait till you retire because it might be too late. You need to do whatever your passion is. You need to pursue it now. And you're important and you have a network. And we're here to help you if you need help on ideas. And you should just do it.
And Marv, if somebody wanted to reach out and get in contact with you, what's the easiest way to do that?
My Twitter is at Marva Baylor, MarvaBaileR. So I guess Twitter, and I'm on LinkedIn, and more than happy to help. And TechBridge, as I mentioned, does support multiple nonprofits, so we are here to help, and we have many volunteering opportunities.
Okay. Who's next? Janet, you're next.
I have no pearls of wisdom, but I do have.
You got nothing.
I do have. I will when I become a doctor. That's when I.
Well, you'll be called doctor.
I'm in my back pocket. I would just add one thing we didn't talk about, and it's probably a topic in and of itself, but it's whether or not the volunteer member gets paid. And that's also going to be another motivating factor. I mean, you know, a challenge for me has been trying to make, sort of like what Diane was describing, a weekend of meetings for my board members valuable. And in addition to just networking with their peers, we typically didn't have speakers come in, but the way we were able to do it, and it's a delicate balance being a nonprofit, but four times a year we would go to a sort of nice place. So it was a little bit resort-like, nothing extravagant, but it was maybe a 3 or 4 star hotel to where at least they could almost have some downtime in between. So I'll just add that. No wisdom.
No wisdom.
And I'm afraid I don't have any pearls. I just want to know, do I have to call you doctor?
Absolutely. Everybody does.
I have to call her doctor, so everybody's got to.
Well, we have a year, so let's get the dissertation finished.
That's right.
I'm just 6 months into it, so I would just... I guess I'll just say that it's been refreshing. It's not something I thought to do and pursued, but now that I'm there, I'm very happy and I'm more motivated to do it. And I agree with you, Marva. Don't wait. And if you can spare the time, it's absolutely well worth it all the way around.
So her pearl of wisdom is say yes.
Yeah.
Make a difference.
Yep.
Right?
Yes, absolutely.
Any contact information for you?
For me, like Marva, on LinkedIn or through the school, which is ilmsnet.com. So Ivy League Montessori School net.com is our website. And be happy to talk to anybody that's interested.
All right. Well, guys, thanks a lot for your time this morning. Certainly value it a good bit. And to our listeners, we certainly appreciate your time and listening. And until next week, be safe.
John Baker is a certified financial planner with a Master's of Science in Personal Financial Planning. Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, Inc. owns the certification mark CFP, Certified Financial Planner, TM and CFP, and in the U.S., which it awards to individuals who successfully complete the CFP Board's initial and ongoing certification requirements. John Baker offers financial planning and securities through Woodbury Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor and broker-dealer, member FINRA. SIPC, located at 1050 Crown Point Parkway, Suite 1675, Atlanta, Georgia, 30338. This program is for information purposes only and should not be considered a solicitation of or offer to buy or offer to sell securities or investment advisory services. Information in this program regarding market or other financial information is obtained from sources which are believed to be reliable. We do not warrant or guarantee the timeliness or accuracy of this information. When considering any registered security products, seek a prospectus carefully before you invest. Make sure you consult your financial professional regarding any specific situation.